My name is Kellen Rusinello. I'm a staff attorney with the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial Counties. If you'll notice, the title of this has changed from addiction vaccines to anti-drug vaccines, and I'll explain a little bit more about why I did that, why I made that change, but it has to do with the mechanism of how these actually work. And I just want to point out that I put my Twitter handle on there in case you want to send me questions, comments, whatever. If you're on your phones, I'll assume that's what you're doing. So, disclosures, the views expressed in this presentation are my own. They don't represent my organization, and I have no financial disclosures. So a little overview of what I'll be talking about today. I'll talk about vaccines generally and the public health importance of them. I'll do a little bit of background on drug misuse, and then I'll talk about how anti-drug vaccines work and where they are in development. And then I'll dive into the legal precedent on mandatory vaccination. And I'm going to spend most of my presentation talking about a general vaccine mandate, so a mandate to vaccine the general population. But at the end of my presentation, or towards the end, I'll talk about other populations that might be targeted that would be a subset of the general population. And I'm doing that just because I think it's the most interesting and most thought-provoking population to discuss. And then finally, I'll wrap it up with some practical and ethical concerns. So vaccines generally, they're hailed as one of the most important public health interventions of all time. The World Health Organization says it's one of the top two public health interventions of all time, the other being access to clean water. And it's been credited with eradicating smallpox and eliminating measles, polio, rubella, and diphtheria in the United States. And there's been significant drops in many other diseases that vaccines have been created to address, including tetanus, hepatitis A and B, mumps, pertussis, and varicella, among others. And they work by introducing a version of the infectious agent to elicit your immune system to have a response to develop antibodies that would then attack the virus or bacteria once it enters your blood system. There are different types of vaccines. I won't get into the super nitty gritty on it, but you can introduce or you can create vaccines that are using live attenuated, inactivated versions of the agent that would cause the disease. But you can also create vaccines that actually, where you create antibodies and then inject the antibodies as the form of the vaccine. And the part of why vaccines and vaccine mandates are have been so effective is this concept of herd immunity, where if enough of the population is vaccinated, then the entire population becomes vaccinated, because even if someone is unvaccinated, they won't be able to transmit the disease to other people because they would be vaccinated. And this is particularly important for people who can't get the vaccine for some reason. It might cause some harm to them. Or for children or older adults, where getting the vaccine might actually cause harm to that person, it's important that the other people have that immunization so that they can't pass the disease to those vulnerable populations. And as I'm sure you're aware, vaccines, since their inception, have been controversial, and vaccine mandates have been controversial. I'm sure some of you have heard about what went on in California this year, the outbreak of measles at Disneyland, which then spread to the rest of the country, and actually resulted in a legislative change in California that eliminated the philosophical and religious exemption to vaccines. So here's some facts about drug misuse. And, you know, the term misuse is a little misleading in that, you know, when you consider the costs, it also includes criminal justice costs, and misuse is kind of, a pejorative term, because people can be using drugs and it might not necessarily be misuse, but due to the fact that they're illegal, would be categorized as misuse. But bearing that in mind, Misuse of tobacco, alcohol, and illicit drugs estimated to cost more than $712 billion annually in the United States. That's including health care, lost productivity, and criminal justice costs. The most prevalent model right now in thinking about addiction is that it's a chronic brain disease. And this dates back to the late 18th century to Dr. Benjamin Rush, who was actually one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And then it gained more support in the mid-20th century, and even more so in the 1990s, which was deemed the decade of the brain, with a lot of more detailed research about how the brain works going on in that decade. But I also want to point out these other interesting facts, is that research has shown that only 10 to 20% of people who ever try drugs actually get addicted to that drug. And this counters the kind of narrative that anybody who tries cocaine immediately gets addicted and there's nothing you can do. Well, turns out that's not really true. It's about 10 to 20%, and that holds true generally across all different categories of drugs. And another interesting fact is that most people eventually will grow out of their addiction. So people who don't go to treatment after a period of some time will eventually grow out of it and learn new behaviors and will not be addicted to drugs anymore. And that tends to differ the amount of time based on the drug. And I can answer some more questions about that later if you guys are interested. So anti-drug vaccines, they work basically the same as other vaccines. So, but generally when you introduce drugs into your body, the molecules are so small and they reach they cross the blood-brain barrier so fast that your body does not have time to intercept them. So what the researchers have done is they started to combine what's called a haptan, which is kind of a modified molecule of the target drug, and they combine that with something, a larger molecule that will slow it down and allow the body to, well, it will prevent it from crossing the blood-brain barrier and allow the body to then react to it. So a lot of these vaccines are using inactivated cholera toxoids, which is what they combine the drug to. And that prevents it from crossing into the brain, and then your white blood cells then have a chance to attack it and develop antibodies. So that next time when you just introduce the drug into your system, your antibodies will be there and able to attack the drug before it crosses it over to the brain. So vaccines are currently in development for heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, and nicotine, which is, I think, particularly interesting to note because nicotine is a legal drug. So in thinking about the mandates, I think that's a particularly interesting one to think about. Right now, the current effectiveness is limited to less than a year. Depending on the vaccine, can be weeks, can be a couple months. And in those trials have shown that there's reduced use of the drug after the vaccination because the person can no longer, even if they take the drug, can no longer feel the effects of the drug. But I'm going to proceed with this presentation with the assumption that a vaccine will eventually be developed or could be eventually be developed that will be long-lasting does not have any negative side effects, health effects, that sort of thing, so that it could be mandated for general population. So the legal precedent on vaccines in the United States, the seminal case is Jacobson versus Massachusetts, which is in 1905. And this is a case where an individual, he was living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The state of Massachusetts had a law that said localities can, in times of epidemic, mandate that people get vaccine, and those who don't can either serve a small jail sentence or pay like a $5 fine, something like that. Obviously, $5 was worth a lot more back then than it is now. So Jacobson did not want to get the vaccine, refused to do so. He was told to pay the fine, said he wouldn't do it, and then he went to court and said, you can't make me get the vaccine because it violates my 14th Amendment rights to due process and equal protection. Well, the court shut him down, basically said that there's no due process rights that are being infringed upon here. There's no equal protection rights either that are being infringed upon here. And it speaks in very broad language about the police powers of the state and the ability of the state to implement measures to protect the public health of people, particularly in times of emergency. Really kind of made a strong argument that vaccines, that mandatory vaccines are acceptable and constitutional. Scholars have looked at this case, you know, over the past 110 years, and Lawrence Gossin, he's a scholar, studies this subject, came up with this framework from the language of the case, which is focuses on necessity, reasonable means, proportionality, and harm avoidance. And just quickly, those basically mean necessity is what is necessary to protect a community from an epidemic. Reasonable means means it, that the intervention is reasonably designed to prevent or ameliorate the threat. Proportionality is it can't go beyond what is reasonably required for public safety and can't overly intrude on personal autonomy. And harm avoidance is this kind of inclusion that in circumstances where it would harm the person to get the vaccine, you need to have an exception for those people. And then a couple decades later, in Zuckerby versus King, the Supreme Court again upheld the constitutionality of vaccine mandates. San Antonio, Texas had a law that said students can't go to school unless they have a vaccine certificate, and then they prevented a student from going to school. And so it went to the Supreme Court, and basically it was a very short opinion, and they said Jacobson decided this already. So therefore, schools can exclude students who have not been vaccinated. More recently, there's been some cases. These two are from Arkansas. And it's interesting because this is almost 100 years after Jacobson, but basically all they say about the matter is Jacobson precludes us from talking about this. It's already been decided. And it's particularly interesting because these cases dealt with the hepatitis B vaccine, which is very different in how it works versus like a smallpox vaccine or something like that. I mean, it's the same mechanism. But a smallpox vaccine is necessary because if you're in the area with people who have smallpox, you can't just not breathe, and it passes through airborne means. Whereas hepatitis B theoretically can be prevented if you can prevent people from engaging in risky behaviors like needle sharing or risky sexual behaviors and that sort of thing. So it's interesting that the court didn't even talk about the differences. It just said vaccine mandates are constitutional. And then even this year, a case out of the Second Circuit basically said Jacobson precludes all due process arguments, but this one was dealing with the chicken pox. So I'm going to try and speed it up here, so apologize if I get a little jumbled. But this is about the applying an anti-drug vaccine mandate to the general population. So we know the adherence to Jacobson is very strong, even for non-airborne diseases, including hepatitis B. HPV vaccines have not really been challenged in the courts yet, at least not that I have been able to find, because a lot of states have, if they do have an HPV mandate, it has a very broad opt-out. Anti-drug vaccines can be distinguished. The herd immunity argument is very weak. You could argue the same thing for hepatitis B and HPV vaccines, but what's particularly interesting in this case is if you're arguing that just getting rid of the pleasure of using drugs is and therefore people won't sell drugs because there's no profit in it, nobody wants to buy it. If that's your argument for herd immunity, then that really kind of emphasizes that you're trying to control behavior and not a disease. So with hepatitis B and HPV, you can also say that they don't prevent the behavior from happening, so people can still engage in risky sexual practices. They can still share needles if they want to. The vaccine only prevents the disease transmission, whereas with an anti-drug vaccine, it would actually prevent the person from, I mean, they could still take the drug, but they won't get any effect from the drug. And then I just want to mention again that, you know, drugs have utility. There's a reason that people use drugs. It's pleasurable. Some people use them for religious experiences. Whereas I would argue that HPV, the virus itself, does not have any utility. Nobody wants to get that sort of disease. So five arguments why this an anti-drug vaccine would be unconstitutional for the general population. One would be that you could consider addiction that it's not a disease, that it's a learning, some sort of learned behavior, and that therefore Jacobson shouldn't apply because how can you vaccinate against something that is not a disease? I'll talk a little bit more about this in a second. The second argument is that, and I think this is probably the most convincing, is that vaccine is not addressing the disease, even if addiction is a disease, it's addressing the behavior. Because it's not addressing the actual addiction, it's addressing the fact that a person is using drugs. I am out of time, but I'm going to just finish up this slide real quick. And if you have questions, feel free to ask me this, and then this is available for download as well. So the third argument would be that addiction is not the type of disease that was in mind when Jacobson was decided. It's not communicable unless you accept that it's communicable by the sense that people can be peer pressured, which I think is a weak argument. Fourth argument would be that the Jacobson model doesn't adequately address this, and this goes a lot of legal scholars talking about what an alternative model would be. It would probably be looking more like a strict scrutiny test to determine whether or not the infringement on personal and fundamental rights is too intrusive. And then finally, I would argue that even under Jacobson's own four-prong test, that this would likely fail. And I have a slide here on that, for what the reasons I think of that. But again, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I look forward to your comments. Thank you.
So we have about 15 minutes or so for questions, and if you have questions, just raise your hand.
Sure. I have a question for you, Professor Meyer. So first, let me, in the interest of full disclosure, say I came to hear the first paper, and
sorry,
but that's okay. I say that you guys did a great job. I really appreciate that. I don't know much about international treaties and water, but I do know that you can measure water and water provisions and sanitation by hookups, by use of aquifers, by infrastructure. And I guess I was a little bit puzzled by your methodology. I recognize you didn't perhaps have as much time as you might have wanted to explain it. But it sounds like you had a process where you went through reports that countries wrote and you identified some key ideas and terms and then you somehow quantified those. So my question is, why not sort of go to the source and look at where water issues are actually measured in terms of provision? Two, how did you address the considerable biases, selection bias, evaluation bias that are inherent in the methodology you use? And three, how did you address the fact that your metric actually changed over time, at least based on your slides, where you went from providing water as a right for personal drinking water needs to providing both water and sanitation?
Okay, perfect. So I think this really gets to the heart of it, that there are lots of different ways to measure water, and right now we have no indicators to tell states what they should report. So they report however it is they want to report, usually in the way that makes them look very good. And so not only that, when they report every 5 years, they change what they're reporting on water and sanitation every time they report. So I have no way of saying longitudinally that things are getting better. As to your first point, why don't we just go to the source and look at water? That would be great, except we're trying to, at the Geneva level, look at the entire world. So we can't do that. So there needs to be some way of aggregating information. So states are collecting information, and I want to make sure, going to your second point, that states are collecting the information that is best reflective of the human right. Now, that raises the question of whether there are biases in the data set. There are huge biases in the data set. their first biases in the data set as to which countries are reporting. Only the countries that are party to this treaty are reporting on it, and not all of the countries are reporting on time or at all. So there are biases in who is reporting, and then secondly, there's a bias in what they're reporting. We have to believe that what states report to the UN actually reflects the circumstances on the ground, or put more simply, that states aren't just making shit up. And they do. But the idea would be to go to every water source in the world to look at that water source, and that would be administratively complicated because it would involve living in a person's life for a year or so and doing it for everyone on the planet. So that's complicated. So notwithstanding these biases, this provides what I think is the only sort of large-scale data set where we can do a quick and dirty every country in the world, how are they doing, and that can provide a baseline for future more in-depth research to ask these questions. How are states putting together their reports? Do these reports actually reflect what's happening on the ground? But first, in order to do that, we need to make sure that states are all reporting the same kind of information, and information that we think is reflective of the human right. Which, of course, brings to your last question, that the metric has, in fact, changed over time. And that's sort of the point. The UN added sanitation to water after 2010. Do state implementation efforts, as reflected in their state reports, match that change in the norm? So we're looking at all the possible norms, and we want to look at how those norms show up in state reports over time. And one would hope that as human rights advance, that state reports are advancing in a corresponding way to match those human rights. We did not find that, and that represents for us a bit of a troubling disconnect, that what the UN is saying in its General Assembly is not matched by what states are doing. What states are doing measured by what states are reporting to the UN. So if we think that treaty ratification happens and then someone doesn't die of water and sanitation access, because apparently that's a hugely important thing, we're being told, then we need to think about everything that happens in between ratifying that treaty and someone having access to water. So this is one step along that pathway.
Thank you. Have your hand up. Yeah. Yes.
My question is for the gentleman that did the privatization of public health. So after the treatment is done, is that the funding to the health department is pushed over to the nonprofit institution that they switched to? And they displaced all the workers and kind of started to move over there. Now they're moving those people back to the state department?
Yes. So
what's going to happen to the nonprofit thing that they put in place that is not going to be the same anymore?
Well, it still exists, but basically the way that it worked was initially the way that the nonprofit got its funding was that they entered into a contract with the state health department that basically said the money that the state used to provide to the city health department is now going to go directly to this institute. And in the process, that also bypassed all the oversight from the city council because it was just a contract between the state and the institute. What's happened now is the state is now giving the money back to the city health department through the city council, you know, through the normal budgetary process, and basically the city put the programs up for bid, and the institute did not get the programs. So they had kind of a transitional step where there were some other providers that were helping, including some of the university health systems and things like that, and now. Increasingly they're pulling them back in-house. And so some of the people did go and work for the Institute and now are coming back and working for the health department again. There's been, as you would expect, a lot of turnover in that process, but a lot of the core staff has remained the same. It's just who their employer was that's changed and what requirements they were subjected to as a result of that.
My question is also for Gable. Does the Department of Health have rulemaking? Do they use it, and do they have that along with it?
They don't have rulemaking power as a distinct entity. So the rulemaking, any kind of ordinance would have to go through the city council and be approved. I mean, they work collaboratively with the city council to get new ordinances passed at the city level. That was not ever passed. They didn't attempt to pass that on to the nonprofit. And I think if they had tried that, that clearly wouldn't have been, it wouldn't have withstood any kind of legal scrutiny. I mean, they set it up in a way so that they still retained the shell of the health department, so that the legal powers were still retained by the government officials. But they were basically just saying, we're going to use our power as these appointed government officials to then delegate the actual implementation to these other people who we have a contract with. And I think that conclusion that was appropriate, I mean, it's clearly appropriate in some circumstances because it's a very widespread practice. You know, government agencies contract with outside providers all the time to provide different types of services. What was different about this was that they were doing it pretty much for almost the entirety of their operations. And so, and it's an unanswered question. Is there a certain point at which the contracting out of services becomes so great that that it becomes legally impermissible? It's not clear whether that's the case, and there's no reason to think that it necessarily would be at one place rather than the other. I think the place where there's most legal vulnerability is the actual application of it. So if workers from the Institute for Population Health are inspecting restaurants or they're issuing... Right. And now technically the person who signs off on it is still the city employee, you know, the health officer who works for the city. And these people are just operating as their proxies. I don't know if that would have withstood legal scrutiny if it had been challenged. To my knowledge, no one ever challenged it, which was a surprise to me.
I'm just curious as to whether or not the CDC had any pushback on funds going outside of the state.
Yeah, that's a good point. I said they outsourced virtually everything. There were a couple of programs that were not outsourced to the Institute because they were prohibited from being outsourced. So one of them I know was Ryan White funding for HIV related services. You know, that agreement with the federal government says that you cannot use outside providers to, you know, you can't have other people do that kind of work. It has to be done in-house at the department. There were a few other programs like that as well. And so those programs, though, retained, there was discrete staff for those programs, and everybody else was, all the other discretionary money was just sent out to the Institute. And they were able to, you know, there were some federal programs that didn't have those restrictions. And so that money came in to the health department, and then they basically paid the Institute to provide the services that they were required to provide through those grants. The other thing that came up in the audit, which was interesting, was that, you know, there are things like vital records registration that the health department was in charge of, and for a while they were taking the fees that they would collect for that, for processing those records, and they, you know, that should go back to the city, but they were putting it into the accounts of the Institute because there was too much intermingling, and that was one of the things that they found when they did the audit, and the Institute had to pay the city back because they had inappropriately been getting some of those fees. So it basically was done really hastily in response to trying to come up with some method to keep the programs in place for public health, but a lot of the actual organizational structure and the legal powers and a lot of the components that really should have been put into place initially were not, and that's part of the reason why it didn't succeed. There were some other problems with the management as well. Ultimately, it ended up being a really short-lived experiment because most of it, as I said, is now going back in-house to the city health department. I don't know if the lessons to be drawn from that are generalizable lessons or not, but I think it's sort of an interesting scenario. Yeah. I'm sorry. Did you hear? Oh, yeah. Quantify budget reductions?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The overall budget of the health department before they zeroed out the budget was about $66 million a year. Now, a lot of that money was not from the city budget. A lot of that was from outside sources, like either the state or grants that came in from either federal government or other places. And so I think the city contribution was like $9 or $10 million a year, and that was the part that was zeroed out. But having this alternative structure, as I said before, you know, allowed for that state money to come in, but it didn't come through the city. It came through this outside group, and they actually completely bypassed the city by the way that they arranged the contract between the state and the institute.
Yes.
It's my question for Dr. Olatosi. Thank you very much for your presentation. If it is true, and what you say, I would believe that any data set can be hacked. And if it's also true that big data can reaggregate data in such a way that even in the absence of hacking, one can go back and learn many, many things about the individual subjects, do you think it's time that we quit pretending that there is data privacy and that we quit spending time, money, and resources on the pursuit of pretense?
I think the pretense makes people feel better, and so we're not going to ever get to that point. The fear I have with the pretense is because we have this pretense, we're not putting in the safeguards that we should, and everyone is basically holding their line to their piece of the pie. Computer experts will tell you, so think about it. Antivirus makers, most of the people are hackers before who got employed into the industry, so then the next group comes and hacks better than them, and everybody goes, so it's a cycle. And we've already got to that stage in a way. We just don't want to tell ourselves that. That's why I ask the question about wearables or Fitbits or things or iPads or this. How many people actually read the whole disclosure? You just sign it up. But if I told you that I got your information, you're going to scream, but you signed it up. So I think what we've done is we've dumbed it down into the subconscious of a lot of people, and we're not paying attention to it. Like I said, the tipping point is coming when we have the big, massive data dump of people's health records. That's when the screaming and kicking is going to begin. But my fear is, can we do something to hold it before it gets there? I think we still have to protect the data, because, I mean, no protection just makes it the Wild Wild West run. But I think we've already got to the point where people are kind of inured. And, you know, identity theft, right? It doesn't affect me. Sorry. It's that.
Can I ask a question along those lines? Just your impression of, you know, I was working on a project once, and we were asking ourselves that, you know, let's say I have protected information, and I'm required to protect that, obviously, but, you know, let's say I'm Kaiser, and we were looking at teenagers, right? And this was not Kaiser, but, you know, so I got teenagers, they come to Kaiser, and they get their STD test, right? And I know what it is, and then it's all protected. But do you think it's probable to make the argument if they go onto Facebook and publish the protected information, is that giving consent for me to explore that at the same level of privacy circle, right? So if they've already told all their friends that they went and got tested for gonorrhea, can then I go do network analysis, right, and see, well, who are they meeting with? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think the two answers to that, within the law as it's currently written, if you're a healthcare provider, you can't do that regardless of what you do.
Right.
Now, the funny thing is, if you're a subsidiary of the healthcare provider, like 3 or 4 steps down, you don't even need their permission to do that. Because the law, the definitions, for example, Department of DHHS is the one that, you know, interprets the regulations. The FTC, too, also interprets their regulations. Both groups have different interpretations of breach notifications and privacy. So you can fall into whatever end. I would still say it, just for protecting yourself, don't try it. Man.
No, we didn't do it, right? But it was this situation. It was like, well, how can we not use this when these?
Everyone's
broadcasting everything to.
Well, HIPAA says you're the HIPAA entity.
Right.
So you can't do that. Now, if you just go down the road, down to another person, which again comes to ethical things. Maybe you can wink to someone with your friend in 2 or 3 places down the road and do.
Hire the subsidiary to provide this information. Oh, thanks. Are there other questions? We have like 5 minutes. Oh.
I have another question for you about the data. So I know that the focus here was on, you know, the bad boys, how to misuse the data. But the data has value, too, for a lot of value for public health. So I'm working on a clinical trials project now, and one of the things we'd like to know is we'd like to know more about adverse drug reactions. And the law requiring reporting of adverse drug reactions is, shall we say, not robust, pretty weak. But if we had de-identified data on a large scale, we might be able to do a better job. So if you could just take a minute maybe to talk about from your experience how some healthcare providers or third parties have used this in a more creative and positive public health fashion, I'd appreciate it.
Oh yeah, the lot of values, I'm one of those. Now think about it, for example, if you're looking at a hospital, you already have all the data you need to do predictions of what will happen next. I'll zero in into a specific condition. Sepsis, sepsis. You have the recorders, you can profile patients up to the point using big data that you know when a patient is going to go to sepsis before they actually get sepsis. The data has been collected in real time. Well, what that does is that you can deploy resources very quickly to the patient's bedside. Your outcome of care is going to be good, the patient's life is going to be saved, it just benefits all around. Their value, we're not going to go away from big data. It is really valuable and key because we already have the data, it's sitting there, nobody's doing anything with it. The problem is that it's a gray area, you know. Again, it's after the fact. We then start thinking, oh, the good people are using it, but of course we know the bad people always exist. And what happens when that happens? Especially for the companies that are subsidiaries right now, will think they're all well protected. Well, eventually there's going to come a point where you're going to pay for whatever will happen.
Yeah, one last question. Yeah.
I just have a quick question for Kevin.
Kevin, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Are there any jurisdictions in the U.S. or outside the U.S. that have gone so far as this?
No, not yet. Although there has been some talk, I mean, theoretical talk. It's mostly because there hasn't been a vaccine that's been approved for human use yet. It's still a trial phase.
Where is that plot?
There is talk in the U.S., the most, I guess, towards that thinking of compulsory vaccination mandate is what actually in the U.K., one of the policymakers. If this was a viability, this could be used in the general population.
Let's thank all our panelists and thank you for joining us.